Welcome to the Total Brain podcast series, hosted by Dr. Evian Gordon, founder and chief medical officer of Total Brain. Today's podcast is on what can people with depression teach us. And it is my great pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague, David Whitehouse, as our key opinion leader. Dr. David Whitehouse, MD, PhD, is a Cambridge University undergraduate, a Harvard-trained psychiatrist with over 20 years' experience with leading managed behavior change companies in the United States. He also has an MBA from the University of Connecticut and a doctorate in theology from Harvard. He's now the psychiatric medical director for Able2, the leading evidence-guided, outcomes-defined, virtual, and digital cognitive therapy-focused behavior solutions company. Well, David, it's wonderful to do another podcast with you. And today's topic is really very deep in its intent. It really is about the way in which psychiatry and mental health has been about, in some degree, them and us. And you and I both know that there is no them and us. Our standardized international database has increasingly shown that all the outcomes, all the deficits, all the brain changes are on a continuum. And the labels are stigmatizing and do not reflect the fact that we all have bits of stress, anxiety, depression, and we are fluctuating every day, all the time, from challenges to well-being to peak performance. And so that fluctuation, I'm really grateful, is now being captured in Total Brain's measures of capacities and of brain state changes in heart rate variability. And so I want to begin, David, with asking you, before we go through a series of questions, firstly, to give your three takeaways.
So thank you again, Evian. And so my three takeaways for tonight are, one, depression, in fact, may be an aberrant journey of self-reflection, which is truly about looking at how we are risks to ourselves in terms of achieving what is most important and valuable to both us and those around us. And we need to understand that to see how we can leverage it for its best effect. The second one is that depression is not only prevalent excessively in our society, but is growing in our society. And that maybe that we need to learn from that, that there is a success dissatisfaction, that everything that we have achieved, we have achieved, but at a price. And every so often, we need to reassess that price in order to maintain our health. And the third takeaway is that there are absolutely things that we can do to maximize the functioning of our brain, to turn this system to best use, to minimize the threat of depression and maximize whatever positive impact it may have on our lives.
Yeah, thank you for that, David. You know, so much of depression has been couched in terms of magnified negativity bias, which is true. But to add this notion about guilt and rumination, that it can help us get better self-reflection about depression, is moving towards looking at the strengths and the lessons we can learn so well. The success to satisfaction, similarly, and the fact that we can forestall it with cognitive brain training and with exercise and diet is, of course, we all know, reassuring, but it's all about understanding, having a framework to do it most effectively. So with that framework about depression and three pointers or takeaways we can riff on, David, let me begin with the first question, which is, what can people with depression teach us?
So I think that they can teach us that self-reflection can actually be a source of wisdom. When we think about some of the circuits and the impact of depression on the brain is across multiple circuits and multiple systems, both in the body and in the brain. But within the brain, some of those circuits have to do with our own decision making. We use the term abulia, that people who are depressed cannot make decisions. But these are circuits that are damaged in this process. And while the brain was first and foremost a threat detection mechanism, it also then had to develop a system whereby it wouldn't just see threat like it we generally feel at the moment in the midst of the coronavirus situation as threat is external to us. When we talk about the fight and flight, we always think of that as, oh, it is the lion that showed up on our door. What is the external stimulus for threat? But in this case, the threat comes from us. The threat comes that we make decisions and we make choices and we have thoughts and values. And our brain put in the same mechanism for threat detection in terms of reflecting on when we don't achieve those goals, when we suffer losses, the breakup of a relationship, the failure of an exam, the loss of a job, and the decisions we have made have ended up badly. The brain perceives that as much as an opportunity for a threat reappraisal as it does for what were we doing being in the wood with a lion anyway? Why did we do that? We need to think about it again. So in that reflective stage, the positive is that the truly reflective self can go through all those thinkings, not catastrophize, not turn it into every time I make a decision, I make a bad decision. You know what? I always disappoint people. They like me at first, but then I disappoint them eventually. Those are the types of cognitions that are not reflective. They have become entrained in circuits which take us down a slippery slope. And that is where cognitive therapy seeks to help us. Because if we can get out of those, we can reflect on what we do, which is self-destructive, which is damaging, and make better and improved decisions.
Yeah, it's such a good example, David, about why cognitive capacities are so important to use more effectively. So in this notion of self-reflection, and that's the lesson we learn, so in a way, the ability to self-reflect in depth is the kind of strength. It's the power that people with depression do have, but it's not deployed that effectively. And that's where the training and the reframing is important. Why, in that light, given our core brain emotions like fear and disgust, where we know that they were there to help protect us from danger, which is our primary goal, why do you think sadness evolves? What's the role of sadness in this dimension of guilt and rumination of the negative, but the ability to self-appraise and take some responsibility, or at least be more aware of that role of our own self-appraisal, our own decision-making in our state?
That is definitely a question I've asked myself. And what is interesting is there has been so much psychiatrically to say we need to distinguish, among other things, for instance, grief from depression. But I think actually that may have been a false dichotomy, because within the original tribe, the elders or whatever who passed on the wisdom and who shortened the training of the adolescent or the child members of the tribe by passing down good things were part of why, when you reflect, why do I feel this loss? Why do I feel this intense abandonment by something? What have I lost? I've lost touch to like one of the best books in my library, the resource of memories, the resource of traditions, the resource of safety, the resource of comfort. And our brain wants us to reflect on that because there is an importance in maintaining that and maintaining that in community and in our relationships with people. So the interesting thing is, it is pain, but that pain is a reminder of the importance. And so it is interesting now that people both have funerals when they allow themselves the kind of ritualistic celebration of the sadness, but also have memorials to celebrate the reflection of all the good things and the positives that got passed down. And I believe that that's a hint to one of the possibilities as to why depression became important. We need to see that in others and say within the tribe, when the loss has occurred, will anybody else fill it? Will the tribe each take care of each other now that this person has gone? And so the reason that we are geared to see it in others and to respond to it with empathy is to make us reflect how we may have a responsibility to fill that in. And if you think about even some of the things we see again in the midst of the coronavirus and some of the suffering and some of the difficult situations that people are in, or after you see the pictures of a hurricane, and why do you respond to even just a television picture of extreme suffering and sadness in somebody? Because it is a pull, a survival pull, to enlist in you your support and your action to do something good. And depressed people can teach us to harness that empathy as a resource.
Yeah, that's for sure. So that's a great example of a strength, Dave, that depth of self-reflection, that depth of self-examination, but also that potential depth of self-compassion. And it's also interesting to me, depression people teach us all the time that firstly, happy people also have sad days. But there is, you know, this them-us gap is just so illusory. But also this ability to really put that lens on the depth of these issues is a huge learning. What about the other big positive about mental health and depression being one of creativity?
Right. I think because part of what it gets at is because it is looking at the decisions we make and so on, within the circuits of our mind that are answering the existential questions of meaning and value and life that come to us in either the tribal literature, the art, or whatever, that in those moments, we are also looking at our values and purpose. And in those moments of self-reflection, the brain, the integrated brain, cannot just be analytically reflective and kind of come up with an actuarial summation of the choices I'm making in life and why did I choose this religion? You know, 48 points on this side, 22 on the other. But they can take us into the right side of our brain and create inspiration and turn that feeling into color and an exposition of what is happening in thought, into music, into poetry, into art. And that is an incredibly human communication capacity to enlist the whole brain in the most extraordinary way to channel circuits with an aim to communicate, to say something which is beyond words, beyond the pure analytical definitive left brain.
So I couldn't agree more, David.
You're a painter. So Evian, so I've seen your paintings and I have been moved by your paintings for exactly that reason.
Well, it's interesting, David, because we'll look at this in more detail with Shelley Carson from Harvard, who's written extensively about creativity. But for me, one of the things about this that you've just said, which is if we look at the difference between analytical self-reflection, which is kind of what's called convergent thinking, which is more kind of practical, but the divergent thinking of creativity is essentially about making new associations, new connections. And clearly with depression, same as with some of the other mental health challenges, because of this depth that you're talking about, of expanding our level of self-reflection. But when you have the depth of looking at whatever is before you, certainly I feel this when I paint, it's like a different bandwidth, so that there's more stuff on the canvas, in my canvas of my mind anyway. So it's like it's creative exploration. It's active to make new connections. There's just more pieces there to make these new connections, which is all creativity is. So I do believe that's a superpower of mental health that is being stretched, that it gives us a bigger brain and mind sketchpad within which to look at things slightly differently. And now that the world is moving towards the inevitable space where innovation really matters, it matters for people's survival soon, according to the World Economic Forum, that's the kind of jobs that are going to be most successful. I think that is one of the other learnings that I think we will learn, all of us together, from people with depression, with bipolar disorder, with all mental health challenges, ADHD, where this increased ability to think a little bit less clichéically, a little bit in a less homogenized way. So I think that's a wonderful sense of hope, and that this can be harnessed more effectively. Any other strengths, David, before we move on to our last two questions?
One of the other strengths of depression is a reminder how far we have come, but how far we have not come. And by that, our incredible ingenuity and creativity has given us a life with multiple choices, more choices, so the brain has to be more reflective, but many of them given by leisure and other things. And yet, for many more thousands of years, the human species developed in a kind of hunter-gatherer world as opposed to an agricultural world. And we exercised much more significantly. And now we understand the relationship of things like exercise to neurogenesis. And we even have a better understanding of the relevance of neurogenesis as an important safeguard in helping cure or alleviate depression.
So neurogenesis as in the generation of new brain cells. Yeah.
And what is absolutely wonderful is the studies which say that our definition of exercise is so distorted, so that when you look at primitive tribes who still live a much more hunter-gatherer existence, they might do 4 hours of labor hunting, gathering, or people do 4 hours working in the fields. If you ask them whether they exercise during the day, they say no, because their working body, their moving their bodies is part of living, is not a separate activity on a Peloton. And it is that level of kind of integration of exercise that doesn't see it as an effort. So it doesn't ever provide a stress even to the brain. Oh, I didn't exercise today. It doesn't provide that stress because it is what has to be done to survive. So it's never seen in exactly that way. And so there are multiple things that suggest to us that part of what we need to regain or be aware of, whether it's in diet or in exercise or in thinking, was some of the simpler things. That we are too hurried, that there was more time to sit and reflect, there was more time to communicate with other people, and that our isolation and disconnection are not going to help our depression, and once you have the depression, become part of continuing that depression. So one of the things that depression can teach us is it can teach us again, what we have lost, and that as people regain that sense about some of the important things that safeguarded us against the rumination, the negative rumination and the stress, need to come back into our lives.
Yeah, yeah. That is a wonderful learning. How nuanced, though, David, that something that was so inherent to where we came from. It's only 10,000 years ago that agriculture even started, and we were hunter-gatherers. And so it's amazing how quickly we have lost that connection, how devastating the consequences are. Okay, David, what should we not say or do to people who have depression?
I think the one that we all know, and you can take it in the current environment, one of the most common is you don't realize how lucky you are compared with other people. What do you have to be sad about? And that is tragically insensitive, because there is probably no way we can actually truly understand what is driving depression. Because there are so many causes, the stresses in that person's life. But in the deep self-reflection about choices that they've made, riches do not buy you out of depression. Having what might appear to someone else to be an external group, large group of friends, does not buy you out of feeling loneliness. So telling people you shouldn't be sad because you're much luckier than everybody else is totally unhelpful.
Yeah, it's actually incredibly dangerous. I know people mean well. And I know when I had a period of depression and people would say, you of all people, hey, well, what have you got to be depressed about? I was shocked because it's so non-conscious. And that's why a deeper understanding of our brains is so critical, because as we strip away the sense of that rationality can get us everywhere. Rationality is the afterthought. Emotions are driving the show. And if that is the case, and it seems to be the case, then the depth of self-reflection that you are talking about is so prevalent and perseverative that to actually dismiss that in such a flippant manner, however well-meaning, I've heard so many people with depression, many say that it's actually had driven them to a very dark place for one other reason, that this was told to them by people who were the closest to them. And that made them feel abandoned emotionally. And that has caused an increased escalation towards the cycle of decline that is the really hazardous part of depression, the failure to reverse these dynamics. So that is absolutely spot on. What should we then say and do to people who have a current episode of depression?
So interestingly, one of the things maybe we should say is we shouldn't say anything at all. But what I mean by that is not leave somebody alone, but be with them. And maybe you can talk more about this, that one of the fears is that people are going to try and fix you, that they are going to take you out. They're going to say, you remember the last time we were together, you really enjoyed when we went to the movies, or you really enjoyed when we went to dinner. And they're going to try and repeat an event, believing if they just recreate all the circumstances, somehow you'll fall back in. And by being able to say, if in those moments, part of what you're thinking is, my brain is telling me internally, or I'm not even conscious, but I think it's telling me I made bad decisions, I don't even deserve to belong to the tribe, to the family. I'm not worth anything. I have nothing to contribute anymore. Then if somebody comes and says, would it be all right if I just came over? I'm happy to sit. You don't need to say anything. but I want you to know that I'll be here. And maybe I'll do something, I'll clean up in the kitchen, or I'll just do something else, but I'll just make myself busy. You don't have to entertain me. But I want you to know that I'm here, because I want you to know that you're important. It is counteracting that feeling that you're not worthy enough, that you are guilty of something and you're not worthy enough to belong to the tribe.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, David, one of the things that we're fleshing out in this podcast series is also this whole question of the way that people show up, the presence. And to me, depression is the consummate example in mental health of dealing with the non-conscious brain directly. And I think what's been underestimated is how much our non-conscious brain picks up about authenticity, that what people say is far, far less than what they do, their body language, their voice tonality. It is shocking to me how powerfully people, by not being present, or what I call aligned is like just being authentically, the intentionality of why they're there and what they're saying is authentically aligned with what the person's needs are, what their both needs are. So the way that people show up, their body language, their voice, saying nothing is not saying nothing if you're there with a presence where your vibrational frequency, your whole tonality, movement, actual present empathy is felt, is one of the most healing things I've ever seen and have ever experienced. And that is a gift from the non-conscious brain to from one person to another that I think is just beginning to be fully appreciated.
Right. I couldn't agree more.
So, David, as usual, our time seems to always just fly. It always happens. Thank you so much for highlighting the depth of self-reflection that depression encompasses and the issues that allow us to learn profoundly from people with depression. And with that, I would like to ask you to just reinforce for us your three takeaways.
So the three takeaways are, first, the gift of depression is a degree of self-reflection which was originally intended to make us wiser, deeper, closer to what really is important and what drives us ultimately to happiness and purpose. The second one is that depression is so prevalent because it is partly driven by a societal and environmental context in which we have lost the roots of what nourished and nurtured our brain in terms of things like exercise and diet and socialization, real socialization. And we need to restore those to maximize our defenses against the negative aspects of depression. And then the third thing is that we can really do something to forestall it, that there are cognitions, and part of the reasons for cognitive therapy, but not even necessarily therapy, because I'm not talking about formal therapy, but cognitive training, that you can really learn how to minimize destructive thought patterns such as catastrophizing, so that when your brain wants to self-reflect, it doesn't rapidly take itself down negative rat holes, but can give you wisdom to make you make different and better decisions in the future, so that cognitive training is a huge opportunity for the emotional brain.
Thank you so much, David. You've really helped us connect deeply to the fact that there is no them and us in depression, just us.
Just us.
And that we all have authentic brain strengths that we can learn from each other, and that together we can all be the best we can be. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you.